It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Connie. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Another beautiful day out there today. We're just going to kind of move on the forecast here. Leave all of that to our friend Roger Hill. A little cool weather coming on the way again, though. I have to tell you that much. Coming up on the program today, in our second hour this morning, we're going to head out into outer space. Actually, no, outer space will be joining us. Mike Fossum, who is an astronaut and will be speaking down at Norwich University, will be splash landing with us coming up at about 10:40 this morning. We'll take your phone calls throughout the program. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin hour number two. And again, astronaut Mike Fossum joins us coming up at about 10:40. Our phone number is 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. We begin this morning with a really beautiful book. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Peter Forbes and Helen Wybrow, who live over on the Knoll Farm over in Waitsfield, and have written this book called A Man Apart. This is about their relationship with a guy named Bill Copperthwaite, and a homesteader who also was a friend of Scott and Helen Nearing. So let's give a nice from Radio Vermont welcome this morning to our friends joining us here. Thank you both for joining us. How are you this morning?
We're doing great. Thank you.
I want to actually begin here and actually steal a paragraph or two about what you wrote to sort of frame this discussion. You say that this is a story of our relationship to a man whose unusual life and fierce ideals helped us to examine and better understand our own. And this is an account of the tensions and complexities of mentorship, the opening of one's life to someone else to learn together. This is the story of how we came to be in these two canoes. This was two canoes that you were in to bury your friend. And it's the story of one man's 50-year experiment in living on a remote stretch of Maine coast. William Copperthwaite was a homesteader and social thinker, an architect and designer, decades older than we were, who challenged and encouraged us to do some of the most important things we have done in our lives. He let us down and encouraged us to pick ourselves up again. We loved one another and we disappointed one another. There are those who knew his influence better and his friendship far longer. We make no claim other than our relationship changed us. So this story is one we are moved to share. Wow, what an incredible couple of paragraphs. Peter, start us off. How did you meet this guy?
I met Bill through Helen Nearing. Back in the early 1990s, I, like a lot of young people, were moved by what Helen and Scott were writing about choices about how to live one's life and what really matters most. And I wrote to Helen, and she amazingly wrote right back, invited me up, and I started a process of friendship with her. I was in my late 20s, she was in her 90s, and the greatest gift that Helen Nearing gave me was the ability to begin to make decisions on my own and to introduce me to Bill Copperthwaite. I helped her in the last years of her life to figure out her and Scott's legacy. And on one day, she said, I want to introduce you to the man that really, you know, was Scott's best friend. And that's how I met Bill.
Mm-hmm. So basically, he was going to try to continue on the legacy of Scott and Helen Nearing. Can you give people that aren't familiar with them the thumbnail on that couple?
Yeah, definitely. So they're great, great New England heroes to many of us because they were fierce homesteaders and idealists. They started their lives in New York City, working around progressive political issues. Scott was redlisted in the days when people could be, called a communist or a socialist. They moved to Vermont. They started an amazing experiment in living that attracted hundreds of thousands of people. They wrote a famous book called Living the Good Life, and then they moved to Maine. And to me, Scott and Helen Nearing, Bill Copperthwaite, Richard Gregg, there's just a long line of these wonderful New Englanders who shape who we all are today. And Helen and I were just really fortunate to connect with the last of that lineage. And so, it, you know, just to take time to reflect on what he meant in our lives is a big deal. It meant a lot to us to be able to do that.
What's the appeal, I guess, to this lifestyle, Helen?
The appeal to Bill's lifestyle?
Yeah.
Well, we write
and the one you've pursued, too.
Yeah. I write a lot in the book about how I wrestled with his lifestyle. I mean, I grew up next door to Dana and Dennis Meadows' homestead in Plainfield, New Hampshire. So I was no stranger to homesteading. We grew a lot of our own food growing up. We had a small dairy. So I always was drawn to that life. I knew that life. I love working with my hands, growing my own food. But Bill was like a whole step beyond this that was so radical. I mean, he lived without electricity or running water. He hauled his water from the stream down the hill. He didn't have a road. He had to walk in either a mile and a half or paddle in, which is what he did most of the time. So he was essentially on an island. And he was a homesteader primarily because of his radical beliefs in not being part of a system of exploiting others and being part of a whole system of commercialism and sort of the whole capitalist system. He was against that. So he had taken it to a whole nother level of thinking and ideology that fascinated me. And his ideas were just really rich.
What a complex guy. I think this was you, Helen, who described him as fierce, quiet, had a fierce, quiet presence with a quick wit and playfulness. I mean, that's a pretty interesting combination.
Absolutely. He was full of contradictions in every moment that you were speaking to him. I mean, he was probably the most idealistic person I'd ever met. He was absolutely true to his values all the way down to the detail of how he lived. And at the same time, he could be incredibly irreverent and ironic and funny, very funny.
You actually, Peter, you wrote at one point, you said that you learned as much from his failures. I don't want to dwell too much on his failures here right at the beginning, but it's a good time to ask this question because you talked about how his failures enabled you to see him as much more of a whole person. What did you mean by that?
I think it goes back a bit to what Helen was saying about, you know, he's a very complex man. We're all complex, right? We all have contradictions. We have values and things that we care about, but it's not always easy to live by those values. You know, we make mistakes, we fail, we have regrets, and I guess I feel really fortunate that I was able to see all of that within Bill. And of course, it wasn't always easy, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
I looked up to him more than a father. You know, he was an elder to me in the greatest ways, and there were things that he encouraged me to do that I'm so grateful for, and there were things where we let each other down too, and all of that's ultimately human, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the playfulness that Helen was talking about, you know, he I think mostly of his relationship with our youngest daughter, Ren, around that she, as a 7-year-old and an 8-year-old, could see something really, really meaningful in this man. And one of the very last times he was in our home in Vermont, I came down early in the morning, and he was sitting in a chair by our wood stove without a shirt on, and our 8-year-old daughter was cutting his hair. And you know, I'll never forget that. She had been granted access into his world, and he did that through kindness as well as through fierceness.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys live here in Vermont. He had this place up in Maine. You eventually built something up there, which we'll talk about. But so how much time would you spend with him? What was your relationship? How did that work?
Yeah, well, it changed over time. When I first met him, I was in my early 30s, and he was in his early 60s, and we connected, and we spent lots and lots of time together. Even though I was living in Boston then, you know, we probably saw each other every month. We'd find ways to connect, and we'd travel. We made trips all across the United States and to Mexico. And I think one of the disappointments, and we write about it in the book, was that Helen and I did not settle there on his homestead in Maine. We had our own dream for service, and I think, you know, every elder probably has a moment when their mentee says, I got to go my own way, and we did that. And we found our own tapestry at Knoll Farm and began to pour our lives into that. And I think in that period, our lives, Bill and our lives, drifted a little bit apart. But we remained side by side to one another right up until his death.
Mm-hmm. You write, too, that one of his great disappointments is that others didn't follow him and move there, too. So why did you guys not do that?
Well, I think there were a lot of reasons. His place is an unusual place to settle. I mean, there aren't many people who would choose to live where he does and the way that he does. I think we certainly could have pulled it off and had an amazing life there, but we had just invested in this farm in the Mad River Valley, which we bought from the Vermont Land Trust as part of their program of helping people start farming and find affordable land. And we really had a dream to do that, not only to farm, but to run an educational retreat center. And so we were giving that pretty much everything that we had. And I think Bill's vision for a community there was something that he had himself wrestled with over many decades and it had never quite been fulfilled, and it wasn't quite clear to anybody exactly what he wanted or how he wanted it. I mean, one of the fundamental kind of contradictions in his character and that we write a lot about in the book is how he was on the one hand a loner and a sort of someone of a solitary nature, mm-hmm. and on the other hand incredibly preoccupied with social change and how did society function and how could society be better. So he was kind of at odds with himself that way. He preferred to be alone, but he was very a social thinker. So his attempts to create community at his place were kind of full of this contradiction and people could feel it. So it never really came to be until he was getting ready to die. He was in his 80s, and he started planning for a community that would take over residence of his place. So it was really only very, very late in his life that he figured that out.
You talk about having that same struggle yourself, that whole idea about doing something that's, you know, or maybe it was you, Peter, talking about something that's relevant for your family but relevant for the world, too.
Yeah, I think we both write about that. I know I write a part about feeling like a big conflict in my life is the desire to be of service and be connected to something larger than my own sphere, and at the same time being a pretty private person, and how those I wrestle with those two a lot. Yeah.
You know, when I first was reading about Bill, I was thinking, wow, you know, the end of this dirt road, I mean, this no plumbing, the whole thing. I mean, it just sounds so isolating. But, and then I'm reading, there's this whole timeline you have about him. I mean, the guy did, like, an incredible amount of traveling.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that I think is so interesting about Bill that gets at what Helen was saying about a life of service. What does that really mean? So Bill was the most important public figure that I have ever met that didn't have a telephone, didn't use Facebook, didn't use Twitter, didn't have a computer. He didn't live at the end of a dirt road, Mark. He didn't even have a road.
Right.
He had a footpath. And yet he was invited to college campuses. He had impact really all over the world. And so I believe so much in Bill, and I am not Bill. So, and the way we took his teachings and what we got from him was our own, you know, how we can lead our lives in service. And I think ours is a more engaged life. You know, we bring people to our farm, we do programming, and I think for Bill that was a little hard. You know, he saw his own life as a life of protest, not actively engaged, but just the way he lived itself was a protest with culture as it is.
No, if I may chime in too, I think one of the things that attracts me most about Bill's life is his economy. He lived on very little money, and because he lived on so little and he had so few expenses, he had an incredible amount of time to be creative and to travel and to think. And he had this list of 300 friends who he would regularly write letters to by hand.
Wow.
He would walk out and post his letters and collect his mail. And that is a dream to me. That's just beautiful, you know, to have that much freedom. And I loved the way he traveled. I mean, he would take very, very little with him. He would spend very, very little money. He would come up with these incredible schemes to sort of make money as he went. Like, he did one trip in Siberia where he landed in St. Petersburg and bought all kinds of fruits and vegetables and put it on the train and sold it all the way across Siberia.
Wow.
Where they didn't have fresh fruits and vegetables, and just that's how he paid for his trip.
Uh-huh.
So he was really inventive and bold. He was an adventurer in like every part of his life.
And he generally, my recollection is his living was through calendars.
That's how he made his living, and doing workshops, building of these yurts, which was, you know, the fact that we have that word in our Western culture is because of this man. And he brought that form of architecture in the early 1960s from Mongolia.
Wow.
You know, and that we can say the word yurt, and most people, at least here in Vermont and Maine,
yeah,
will say, oh, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
That's because of Bill Copperthwaite.
Wow.
And never had any formal training in architect, but an architectural pioneer in the same way that Buckminster Fuller was an architectural pioneer.
Wow. We're talking with Peter Forbes and Helen Weibrow about their book, A Man Apart, Bill Copperthwaite's Radical Experiment in Living. Why do you think he took you guys under his wing?
He took many, many people under his wing, and I think that's the really extraordinary thing. When he died, there were 4 different memorial services in different parts of the country of communities that he had literally taken under his wing and that he had poured himself into, and we didn't know those communities. I think that Helen and I were just the ones that were at a place in our lives where we could answer his call to come and build something alongside him. But there are many, many people who could have written this story about him, truly. That's the extraordinary nature of him. And we talked today about being connected, you know, through all the various forms of social media. Bill was a man that was really connected in a very human, relational way to communities all over the country.
Now, Bill died in 2011 on an icy road in Maine.
Yeah. Same way Helen Nearing died.
Yeah, very ironic.
You know, a guy hardly ever spent any time in an automobile, and so intentional about his life. He really was making a handmade death in the last years of his life, and he didn't know that he would go the way he did. But that's the way he went.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back, continue our discussion. Peter Forbes and Helen Weibrow joining us. We're talking about A Man Apart, Bill Copperthwaite's Radical Experiment in Living. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
It's on to the ECACE semifinals for the Norwich University Cadets. I'm George Kummer. The Cadets play host to their rivals from Rutland County, the Castleton State Spartans, on Saturday night at Craigsburg Arena. And this is the place to be listening for all the action. Join Corey Gustafson and me. Norwich and Castleton, Saturday night, ECAC semifinal action on the Northfield Savings Bank, WPEV Norwich Hockey Network.
There's no time like now to drive a new Nissan, and Formula Nissan in Barrie has received special shipments direct from the factory with Nissan Now sale event discounts. Jack Castellaneta, nobody has these savings, and nobody makes it simpler to save money.
With our factory direct pricing, you can forget the sticker, forget dealer markups, and just get the best Nissan price. We make it simple.
And you're not kidding.
Formula Nissan prices beat flyer ads, newspapers, even internet pricing.
There's a reason people drive from Hardwick, Burlington, even St. Jay and White River Junction. Our prices are simple, and simpler means cheaper.
Up to $6,000 right off the MSRP of brand new Nissans. All the selection you need and simple, straightforward, factory direct pricing that will save you thousands.
No matter where you've been or what you've been offered, you'll do better at Formula Nissan during the Nissan Now sales event. We're on the Barry Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut and at FormulaNissan.com. Let us show you how easy it is to do business here.
On February 2nd, we all wait to see if the woodchuck will make an appearance. Well, shut my mouth, WSMM's Groundhog Opry, the most anticipated music event of the year, is back for a 1 month close to home world tour. Sponsored by Vermont Country Radio, WLVB, and WDEV, will start at the Hyde Park Opera House on March 7th, Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. For more information, Google the Groundhog Opry for tickets and other places we're going to be. Sponsored by WLVB and WDEV. Groundhog Opry, oh boy.
It's no secret, Mihuron Supermarket is a great place to shop. I'm Tom Mihuron. For over 7 decades, Mihuron's has been catering to the needs of the Mad River Valley and beyond. We have custom-cut meats, fresh produce and seafood, regular and organic grocery, locally produced foods galore, topped off by an extraordinary wine and beer department and a state liquor agency. Shop Mihuron Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center, Waitsfield.
Back continuing our discussion, we've been talking this morning with Helen Weibro and Peter Forbes about their book, A Man Apart, Bill Copperthwaite's Radical Experiment in Living. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. So are you two big rejectors of society, capitalism, the whole ball of wax? You're laughing. All right.
I wish I was more of a rejecter of it. I feel like I'm totally enmeshed in it. It's been sort of an irony, even with this book, of feeling this pressure to promote it and put it on Facebook and do all these things, which is so antithetical to what we were writing about. Uh-huh. So I think it's a tension that any thoughtful person today has. You know, how do you live in this system that's kind of got its tentacles in every part of your life and also have some individuality and some respect and sort of self-respect? It's difficult. It's difficult, you know.
I think the thing that Bill really taught us was how to carve our own life, how to make our own unique life, whatever those choices are, that they feel that they're authentic to us. And so, no, we don't live now exactly the way Bill did, but there's a lot of his life that we have imbued in our lives and taught our kids and hopefully held up for our friends and our community, and that's important. But we don't live at the end of a mile and a half long trail. You know, we live in a town and we have a farm, and we've taken the parts of Bill's life that has the most meaning to us. And that's nonviolence and beauty. Living is simply real community engagement. But we've done that in our own way, and it is different from Bill's. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make his story any less important. That's the power of his life, is how it touched so many people and encouraged us all to live a little bit differently.
Which of you wrote this? The reason the world needs you to be intentional about what's meaningful is so you can create more beauty and nonviolence in the world.
Yeah.
Is that you?
That was me.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are you doing in your life that's creating more beauty and nonviolence?
Oh, my gosh. I begin with how I try to be a dad, and the art of my life. One of which is something Bill told me, which is just the carving of a simple wooden spoon. You know, when I met Bill, I didn't really know how to use my. I was a photographer, but I didn't know how to use my hands at all. And Bill, in that simple act of teaching me how to carve a wooden spoon, help me to do all the things that we've done here in Vermont, from manage a forest to decide that we wanted to live completely without petrochemicals and heat with wood and get our electricity from solar panels, and that we would be audacious enough to invite people to our farm to have conversations that hadn't existed between the environmental movement and the social justice movement. All of that comes from these simple things that Bill taught us and encouraged us to do.
Mm-hmm. What would you add to that?
I think one of the things that that's really important to me is that people understand from this book that you don't have to live like Bill to be somebody who creates meaning and beauty in the world. You can do it in any way, in any place. You could do it in a little apartment in the middle of a city. It's really about kind of sifting through all the data and all the kind of machinery of the world and deciding what is really truly important to me and what do I want to have define who I am. And I think it comes down to relationship. How do I treat other people? How do I nurture my friendships? How do I reach out to people that I might be afraid of or feel uncomfortable with? Like, how do I just kind of walk that integrity and that beauty?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's, I think what Helen just said was beautifully stated and really important. I think at the core of what I personally learned from Bill was how to be something of an edge walker in my relationships. I mean, when I met Bill, we were really, really different creatures. I mean, different in age, different in backgrounds, and that we hung in there for 25 years in our friendship through thick and thin is taught me a lot. And I want to always be open to others, particularly others who are different from me, so that I might learn from them and that they might learn from me. I think that's the biggest gift that Bill Copperthwaite gave me.
What do you mean, edge walker?
I mean someone who is able to walk across boundaries. You know, it feels in a lot of the United States right now, there's a lot of things that divide us, right? And there's boundaries and edges, and sometimes they're actually gated communities, and there's no trespassing signs. And Bill kind of disregarded all that. He looked at you and saw you for who you were, no matter the size of your wallet, the color of your skin, whether you had education or not. And I value that tremendously. Hmm. It has made me a more whole person.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean by edge walking.
What did he teach you that has made you a better father?
I think there's a lot in me and the way I was raised that strives for things, strives for service, or strives to make change. And Bill taught me over and over again that striving isn't nearly as important as how I am every day, when I wake up, when I go to bed. And that's really important stuff.
What'd you learn from Bill, Helen, about nurturing friendships? How do you nurture your friendships?
Well, I always admired Bill for how many letters he wrote and how he didn't let the fact that he was isolated up there in Maine stop him from being really close to people. He nurtured friendships over decades and decades. We're getting letters from people now who knew him when he was in his 20s. And he just, I guess I learned about longevity and continuity, how it's important to like never stop reaching out to people, not to take friendships for granted. Sometimes his letters would be really simple, or a little postcard with a sketch on it or something, but it meant so much to just always be knowing that he was there. And I think he also took great interest in he was a project person. His mind was always inventing ideas and designs, and he would reach out to people and say, what do you think of this? How would you do this? Can you give me a better idea or a better material? Or he also had this incredible love of literature and books, and he had this list on his desk of books, out of print books that he wanted to find, and he would write to people and say, can you try to find me this book? So he engaged people in whatever he cared about, which I think is kind of rare sometimes. You know, I found it to be rare, and I would like to do more of that myself. I aspire to that.
The other piece is time. You know, he made time for people, and that's an extraordinary thing. I really work at that too, and it's hard. I mean, the demands, most of us, we both work, we farm, we're parents. It's hard to find time, and Bill always made time. If you walk down that path, he made time for you. When he was in your home, he made time for you. And I try really hard to make time.
How do you do that?
You know, for me, it's I have to be really organized to make time. I have to be really intentional about the time that I have and spend it on things. And I guess I have to make choices about not spending time on things, too. And that's a lot of what I learned from Bill was about intention. You know, really spending time on the things that matter most. And of course, those are different for different people, and they've changed for me as I've grown and matured.
Okay. I'll take you at your word on that.
Thank you.
You can put your headphones on there. That'd be great. We're going to take a couple of calls. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. That's all right. Nothing.
I just spilled some water.
We're not going to electrocute anybody. All right. Let's go to Middlebury. Bill, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Mark. I was just thinking a little bit when your guests are talking about, you know, living in being peaceful and beautiful and, you know, basically being a pacifist. One of the things that continually bothers me every day is getting my head around what happens over in the Middle East, ISIS. And I was just wondering what your guests and Bill, you know, how they react to that and wrap their head around, you know, the continual violence that we see and, you know, the terrible tragedies over there.
Or do you just shut it out?
Right.
Yeah, I would say that Bill would never shut that stuff out. He was incredibly well informed. He listened to the radio all the time, and he was most of all at his core a pacifist. He really believed in nonviolence, and he really saw the whole, he would have seen it as a systemic problem of imbalance, of exploiting of resources and power, and he regarded all that kind of stuff as a great tragedy and felt like you had to start with your individual life of sort of doing things that would counteract that kind of violence and exploitation of people and resources. You know, start with yourself and start with your community. And he felt like that was at the core of all of those big conflicts internationally.
Thank you for that question. I think Bill's response also would have been to consider what he could do in his own individual life that relates to the fear and othering and violence that's going on. Bill might respond by saying, I'm going to sit down and have a cup of coffee with someone that I don't know and get to know them a little bit better, because that's a step toward reducing the fear and the animosity that is so present in a lot of our world right now.
I guess I appreciate your comments on that, but I guess in a deeper level, my whole problem is just understanding how this can actually happen, and you know, how people can morally, I guess, feel it's okay to do what they're doing over there.
Yeah. Man, I'm totally with you on that. I think Bill had very little respect for religion, because it can become so extreme in its ideology, and it can justify horrific acts. I don't know where you go with that one. I'm pretty stumped on that one myself.
Bill's commitment to nonviolence, I think, arose from the violence that he saw around him and the violence that was in his life as a young man. The violence he experienced from a father who, as a result of the Depression, couldn't find work and found the bottle. And so Bill saw violence, and we all in different ways see violence in our lives. And his response to that was to, as much as he possibly could, to live without that violence around him and to practice peacemaking through his everyday actions. And for him, that meant living as simply as he possibly could without exploiting anyone else. And he would say that over and over again. I am not living out here in the woods to escape. I am living out here because it is the way that I can be a peacemaker. I cannot exploit anyone else.
Let's go to Randolph Center. Mary, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning to your guests. I'm starting to look around my house and wanting to pack after listening to your wonderful guests and the simplicity of thought of a simple life. My husband and I did that in Alsted, New Hampshire, is where we first learned about the Nearings, and, of course, lived out there without water and electricity for a few years. But we do. We all get so caught up. So it's wonderful to hear their story and hear them talking about Bill. And I hope their book lands in every library in Vermont so that people can take parts and pieces of that that they can fit into their life. So very inspirational. Can I just ask, are you self-sustaining on your farm?
No, not entirely. We do grow a lot of our own food, and we grow grass-fed lamb, and we have a organic blueberry farm for pick your own, and so we eat a lot of blueberries and lamb. But no, we're not entirely self-sustaining. Certainly our philosophy of farming is to try to be as closed loop a system as possible, so we don't feed any grain, that kind of thing. We try to really produce all of our own soil building, compost, all that kind of stuff. So we're working in that direction. That's definitely a goal, but no, I wouldn't say we're totally self-sustaining.
How about financially sustain? You're financially sustainable, obviously, if you've been around, right?
Yeah, our farm is certainly financially viable. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
One thing I wanted to mention, because the caller was talking about the joy of simplicity, there's so many wonderful symbols of that the Nearings, you know, old-time Vermonters gave to us. And while we can't, Helen and I can't always lead our lives just like that, we bring those symbols in, and one of them is the wooden bowl. When back in the 1940s and 50s, when anyone was visiting the Nearings down in Jamaica, Vermont, they would eat their food out of a wooden bowl. And so we've carried on that tradition at Knoll Farm of when guests come or our retreats happen, that we eat all of our meals out of that wooden bowl. And just such a simple thing. We've had alumni from all over the country tell us that just bringing out that wooden bowl even reminds them of their goals and values, even when we can't always live the way we would like to live.
Talking with Peter Forbes and Helen Weibra about their book, A Man Apart, Bill Copperthwaite's Radical Experiment in Living. This was interesting. The two of you decided to write every other chapter, which we were talking about during a break, can be kind of a lame literary device, but it totally works in this book. And part of it is because you two had a completely different relationship with this guy. So describe the difference that the two of you had in terms of your relationship with this guy.
Well, Peter knew Bill longer than I did. I met Bill through Peter. And I think my relationship with him was simpler in some ways. He wasn't a father figure to me. He was somebody that I just delighted in. I really connected with his sense of humor and his love of literature. And I was, you know, I would go up to his homestead with our kids when they were little and just really immerse myself in his place, and I was just kind of in heaven. So I had a little bit simpler relationship with him, I think, which deepened as he aged and as he kind of drew me more into his world of design and ideas. And So we had a real connection in terms of ideas, and as did Peter. But Peter also did a lot of conservation work with him, and a lot of kind of nitty gritty work, which had more conflict embedded in it.
Yeah, I think our relationship was more along the lines of elder and mentee in a way. Bill always said that he didn't want to be called the teacher because he thought there was hierarchy in that, but he was an amazing teacher in all respects. And so I went to him almost immediately as a student. I wanted to learn from him, even though we never said things about that. I remember after my first visit with him, I was living in Boston. When I got back down into the city, in those days, you know, we had televisions and not laptops and things, and I unplugged that TV and I pushed it into the farthest corner of my closet. And not because he suggested I do that, but because just being around him made me want to create more space in my own life for something. And so I think our relationship was a little bit more loaded because he had expectations of me, I had expectations of him. We were partners in a lot of things. And there were moments where definitely we let each other down, I know that, and where we also held each other up.
Okay, tell me about one where you let each other down.
I think in the most fundamental way, the fact that Helen and I did not go and move to Dickinson's Reach in down East Maine and bring our family there and our ideals there, I think that was the most fundamental letting down. Like I said to you before, I think in every student-teacher relationship, elder-mentee, there's a moment where the mentee, the apprentice, says, I've learned what I can learn. I need to go on with my own life. I need to pursue my own dream. And Bill wanted that for us. And he was also deeply sad that we moved 350 miles away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be hard, too, when you have a vision such a powerful vision and you hold values so tightly. You want others to take those values, but it's also hard when they do.
Well, it's a rejection. I mean,
in a way.
Yeah.
In a way, but it's not. I mean, I never rejected Bill in that sense. What I said to him was, I want to take what I've learned from you and fully imbue my life with that. And there were many others that did that, but you're right, Mark. I think he took it as a rejection.
I'm sure that's how he took it.
Yeah.
So how did you two work through your difficult parts of your relationship?
Not always well, you know, and particularly because it had to be done through letters. Once we were here in Vermont, and those letters were slow to come and go back and forth, and we had a difference of 30 years of age. So when we could address it, I would go to him. I would get up early in the morning, and I'd say, let's go for a paddle. And we'd be out on the water as the sun was coming up. And in those moments, I could say, Bill, I love you, and I've been disappointed. Or I could make requests of him. But when we got into the building of the yurt, things were moving so fast, there was no time for that.
When did he disappoint you? Whenever. Was there, you said that there were times you disappointed him. When did he disappoint you?
I think around the building of this structure, I wanted to be seen by him as a co-designer and a collaborator, a partner, and I think he had had so many years of building yurts that he treated me more like a client, and I know what that means to someone, you know, mm-hmm. that's a dismissive, you know, almost like the boss, or it's different than being a partner. And you can imagine that what I might most have wanted from Bill was to be seen as his partner.
Mm-hmm. Acceptance. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very age-old human thing.
Well, particularly if this is somebody you view as something of a father figure, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you have any of those same challenges?
I did a little bit. I write about one in the book about when we were building this beautiful concentric yurt with him, a two-story round structure, and he was a big proponent of what he called democratic design, where it was kind of co-created and everybody could learn how to build their own shelter. It was all done with volunteer labor. He was a big believer in that. And at some point, I realized this was autocratic design. He was basically telling us what to do. And I had some conflicts around with him of feeling like he wasn't going to design certain parts of this structure and I just had to do it even though I didn't know what I was doing and I wanted more guidance from him. But it was this strange dance, which I think many of our listeners will understand when you have someone in your life who you look up to and you need and want information and guidance from them. And at the same time, you want them to recognize you as an intelligent, competent person. It's like this funny dance that you do. And that we got into that in the building of the yurt, which I write about. And it ultimately was an amazing learning experience, and I'm really grateful for it.
Mm, the metaphor of the building of the yurt. Hmm. Let's take a call from Indiana. Richard, good morning.
Hey, just to affirm your power of radio, I just bought the book on Amazon and just downloaded it onto my Kindle lens.
Wow.
As for this conversation, I can't wait to start reading it.
Wow.
Thank you.
That is powerful. Yeah. Do you have any questions?
Yeah. No, I just want to get into that book. It really sounds fascinating.
Why?
Anyway,
interview. What sounds so fascinating to you about it?
Well, the analogy that some think that they might be, I just read a little squib there on Amazon that they kind of likened him to maybe another Thoreau, and Thoreau always fascinated me. And I think anything kind of back to nature and simple living, and I can't live that way, but I'm always fascinated by people who can.
All right. Thanks for calling.
All right. Have a good day.
You
bye-bye.
Too. 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. At the end of March, you're having an event over at the Big Picture Theater about the book. So what's going to happen there? Are you going to build a yurt that day, too?
Yeah, we should, right? we actually
at
might.
At least hold it in a yurt with maybe a little lamb with blueberry sauce.
Maybe we'll carve some spoons.
Yeah, maybe we'll carve some spoons. No, we're having a sort of party to celebrate the release of this book. So we'll be doing showing a lot of slides. Peter's photographs are in the book, and they're absolutely gorgeous. They're 25 years of photography of Bill's homestead. And so we'll be showing those, and we'll be doing some readings. And then our dear friends Ronnie Arbo and Daisy Mayhem, who Ronnie and her husband also knew Bill. They spent a lot of time up at his homestead with us. And they are releasing a new CD this spring, so they'll be in concert at the Big Picture right after our reading. And they'll be ripping it up with some amazing bluegrass and old-time music. So the book signing's at 4:30, and I'm sorry, the slides and the readings are at 4:30, book signing, and concert tickets go on sale at 5:30, and then the concert's at 7. You can find more information about it on our website, which is billcopperthwaite.net.
Okay, and that's Copperthwaite. Is it connected to the Knoll Farm site, too?
Yes. So
okay,
if you go, it might be easier to remember Knoll Farm, which is Knoll Farm.org, and then you can go to Bill Copperthwaite.
Bingo. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about grief. We'll do that right after this.
This is Roger Williams at 802 Toyota. February is the month to celebrate Washington's birthday, Valentine's Day, and cold hard cash savings at 802 Toyota. You can get 0% financing on 11 different Toyota models, including the top-selling RAV4, Corolla, and Tundra. Leases customized to fit your lifestyle and budget, and the respect and personalized service you deserve. We have special cold hard cash deals on every new Toyota in stock, and with over 300 available, you're sure to find the right one for you. We don't have powdered wigs, singing presidents, or flying cupids. Instead, we have something you can use. Cold, hard cash savings right now at 802 Toyota. Visit our website at 802toyota.com to browse our entire inventory and see all the cold, hard cash specials, or come visit us at 30 Berlin Mall Road in Berlin, Vermont. We're easy to find. Just click on 802toyota.com, call 844-802-TOYOTA, or drive to exit 7 off Interstate 89. We're just minutes off the exit. 802 Toyota, driving to be Vermont's number one Toyota dealer.
All right, Mason, open wide so the good dentist can check for cavities. You know, it's Pet Dental Month here at One Stop Country Pet Supply, and you need to keep those chompers looking their best.
How's this? Do I have cavities?
Looks great, Mason. You've earned yourself a new toothbrush, paste, and some dental chew treats.
Jeepers, that's awesome.
Remind everyone, darling, that One Stop has dental care items for us felines, too. And they're on sale at 15% off.
Hey, Guinness, give me a big old smile and show everyone those beautiful bicuspids. Wahoo! I love saying bicuspid.
Hey, pretty boy. See these chompers? I keep them clean by using my favorite holistic alternatives I find at One Stop Country Pet Supply.
Wahoo! We're celebrating Dental Health Month through the end of February, and all dental health care products are 15% off. I love this store. I do.
One Stop Country Pet Supply, Brattleboro in Berlin, Vermont, and Emerald Street in the center at Colony Mill, Keene. Open every day.
In your life, there will be times when you'll need knowledgeable legal representation that is supportive and effective. Consider Anderson & Associates in Stowe. For 20 years, they have provided skillful representation in civil litigation matters, divorce and custody disputes, criminal defense, and business transactions. Contact Anderson & Associates online at AndersonLawVT.com or call 253-4011 and speak to Peter Anderson, Maureen Parker, or Todd Shove. Anderson & Associates, trusted advisors and experienced representation, proudly serving businesses and individuals throughout Vermont.
Folks, Dan Keene here, owner of Lamoille Valley Ford. If you want to save big on your next truck, listen to this. The all-new 2015 F-150s are slowly starting to arrive, but the real opportunity for you to save big money is on the last of the 2014s. At Lamoille Valley Ford, we intentionally stocked up huge on 2014 F-150s, and with over 80 available, we have one of the largest selections in New England. But when these trucks are gone, they're gone. Right now, you can buy or lease any new 2014 F-150 in stock at Lamoille Valley Ford, and we'll take $3,000 off. Combine that with already huge Ford rebates and discounts, and that's up to $10,250 off a new F-150 at Lamoille Valley Ford. Folks, I'll guarantee you two things. This is a great deal for you, and these trucks will not last long. So drive Route 14, 15, or 16 to Hardwick and the Great American F-150 sell down happening right now at Lamoille Valley Ford.
Right, back, continue our discussion. Peter Forbes and Helen Weibrand, the author of A Man Apart, talking about their friend Bill Copperthwaite. As we mentioned, Bill died in this tragic car accident in 2011. You know, I know you guys are totally stunned. So how have you dealt with him not being here?
Oh, it's such a good question. I've felt like when this book arrived in the house about a month ago, I couldn't even really look at it or open it. It brought back so much grief, which I had sort of been working through for the past year. And writing the book was very healing, being able to just kind of drive through that sorrow with a lot of memories and stories and correspondence with people to gather the stories. It was really, really helpful. And also burying him was very healing. We had an incredibly powerful experience of paddling his body in a homemade casket, lashed across two canoes, across this bay and into an inlet to his home, just a couple of days after he died, with a group of his very closest friends and our closest friends. So that did a lot to help kind of connect with the reality that he was gone. And I think in grief, so often that's the first step. That's that huge initial plunge is, okay, he's really not here anymore. I have a new relationship with this person now, and it's more about memory and essence and his spirit being among us, and I can't just go and talk to him anymore.
There's not much I can add to that. As beautifully said, for me, it's that I loved his homestead so much. The land up there impacted me so much. And I think when there is a heartbeat on that land again, when a new family moves there, that's when I will be able to really land where Helen has land. Because I still go there, I still feel that place, but I feel the missing of his heartbeat there, his presence, particularly on the land. So, and that, yeah, that's human too. And a new family will come and live there and homestead there, and that story will continue on. And we'll be asking ourselves merely, you know, what would Bill say? What mm-hmm. would Bill do?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for coming in. What a great book. What a great story. Thank you very much. Peter Forbes and Helen Weibrow are the author of A Man Apart, Bill Copperthwaite's Radical Experiment in Living. And again, a reminder, they're going to have an event coming up on the 29th of March up at the Big Picture Theater in Waitsfield. That's going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Keep your dial right here. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is next.